Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast.
Where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yes. So today we're talking about the story. Uh-huh. The story that spawns all other stories.
Yes.
I do love that view of what's Lewis and Tolkien and, mm-hmm. and all that. You know, this is the story.
The true myth.
Right. Exactly. To Know Christ Jesus by F.J. Sheed. And I think that's a Frank? Is that his name?
Yeah, Francis. Frank or sometimes Francis.
Yeah, I mean, Francis Frank is Joseph Francis, Sheed.
Yeah.
I know him from Theology for Beginners, which is a book I return to.
I really it's not really for like beginners. It's deeper than you think.
Yeah. It's so good. You know, when you, I love to reread that. I always come away with something else and, reminders of things like the soul and, angels and, spirit and all these, you know, what are these things? He talks about that in Theology for Beginners.
Yeah, and he is a really accessible writer, and I believe, I should have looked this up. I think he did a lot of, like, sidewalk evangelization sort of stuff.
Oh, really?
I could be wrong.
You know what? He mentioned that in this book. And,
okay.
You know, because I just remember a line where he said that in this group, I can't remember what the group was called, he doesn't, there's three things that he doesn't, they don't let people go out and talk about without knowing what they're talking about.
Oh, yes.
And he listed three things, and I don't have that in front of me. It would take, I don't know how I'd find it in this book, because I don't have an e-book. I have the actual paper book here. But that seems rare to me nowadays. I do have, I'm sitting in a room full of books, but it's like...
Read them. Never.
Yeah, but
do they have
still...
it on the Kindle?
Yeah, probably do. I don't know. But usually on a Kindle, I could just look it up. But
yes.
But yeah, that's interesting you say, because I didn't make the connection until then that that's what he did, you know, and that was like sidewalk stuff. And
I'm thinking Sheed and Ward
mm-hmm.
was a publisher. I thought they were British, but maybe not. But they published Christian Catholic books.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see that on a lot of different old books. And this was first in 1962. And I think, though, what I was thinking, though, is it's because he's used to just having conversations and explaining things, kind of like they do on Catholic Answers and sort of thing.
Yeah.
But he makes it so easy to understand. He makes it really accessible.
Yeah.
Because this book puts together... Well, that makes it sound like they're just sliced together. But this book looks at Jesus' life in terms of all four Gospels together.
Right, right. And
so,
yeah. The reason that I picked it is because, I think I mentioned this last time at the end of the last podcast, but I still can't remember who said this, but somebody said, you know, I'd like to read A Life of Christ every Advent. And I would just thought that was a terrific idea. So... here we are at the beginning of Advent.
You're right.
Yeah, and I just thought, man, this, you know, I want to pick that up, that practice. And so it's interesting when you look at lives of Christ, how many have been written, and sort of the different emphases of them. So one thing that we did here, we did Jesus of Nazareth. I think we did more than one. I don't know that we did all three.
I thought we did, but
yeah,
anyway.
maybe we did. That was a trilogy. Jesus of Nazareth was a trilogy written by Pope Benedict the 16th, our friend of the pod. And,
yes.
And that was like
a life of Christ, though.
Yeah. Well, not like this one, right? That one was like a delving into the teachings and life of Jesus, really. But it was deeply theological. There was a lot of reflection, and that about theology in that. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that you wouldn't call that a life of Christ. I kind of thought that it would be, but again, you know, thinking about the emphases of different ones, mm-hmm. it's almost like a meditative thing that Benedict was doing.
Well, and he was, but I think he was digging deeply. He wrote at least the first one as an answer to a Jewish theologian who mm-hmm. deeply looked at the life of Christ and then said, but I can't convert because here are my problems with it.
Mm, yeah.
And he was kind of answering some of that while he was going through the life, the ministry of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did the Passion, and then he did the infancy narrative to finish it off. And so although he was talking about Christ's teachings,
mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like he was talking about the life of Christ, which also includes, you know, like this book does. Mm-hmm. What would it be like to have been part of the Holy Family?
Yeah.
What kind of things would,
sure.
And I could just mm-hmm. be too narrow in my definition, but like when you, Fulton Sheen also wrote
right.
The Life of Christ.
And he wrote The Life of Christ, and I have not yet read that one, although I own a copy.
Yeah, it's really good. It's like, and it's kind of structured in a way like this. And then there's Romano Guardini, who, oh my gosh, how could I have forgotten that until this moment when we're talking about these? But Christ the Lord is that one. And that's my favorite of all of them. All of them. They're okay. All really good.
That one is going to be on my list for next year then.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, we read that book on the Rosary that mm-hmm. you wrote.
Yep.
And this is just like, take that and like times 100.
Oh,
know?
Wow. Yeah.
Because he's talking about
that one packs so much into a small space.
I know, right?
Yeah. It was unbelievable.
And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there are others. In fact, I think that, and we should put links to these, I guess, in the show notes.
Sure, yeah.
But I'm trying to think.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have to. Oh, Henri Daniel Rop, R-O-P-S, who's a French theologian who I love.
Mm.
From the, maybe, wrote a lot of things of, in like the 20s, 30s, 40s. And he wrote Jesus and His Times.
Okay.
And that was really a good book too.
All right. Excellent.
So
very good. Okay. So yeah, I'm getting that stuff written down here.
Yeah. Cause they all reflect on not only what was the context of the times, of course, but what was the inner life going on. And it doesn't mean that, there, what did Jesus think about this? It's like, what was he showing us and teaching mm-hmm. us that affects our inner lives?
Right.
And we can see that through the apostles and all the things. I mean, they're really great books.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, absolutely. And so right here in the foreword, Sheed talks about what this book is.
Okay.
So he says, this book is not a biography. There is too much of Christ's life upon which no light falls for us, and the accounts we have of the two or three luminous years are written by men not biographically minded. It is not a gospel commentary either, though written in light shed upon the text by many scholars. My concern with the Gospels is to see the face which through all the centuries has looked out from them upon men. The object is not to prove something, but to meet someone. That we should know Christ Jesus, know him as one person may know another. As Christians, we love him, try to live by his law, would think it a glory to die for him, but how well do we know him? And so that, in a nutshell, is what he's doing here. And he talks in that foreword about, well, you know, if you really want to get to know him, then spend time in the Gospels, right? Pray and, mm-hmm. and things like that. But he's saying that his book is not going to be the sole way to do that. He's saying, you know, I'm illuminating what I can of Gospels, but you need to read those. And in fact, while you're reading, he often says, go read this. Come back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he actually says that in the book. Go read Matthew chapter 25 and come back here, you know. And I did do some of that as I was reading this time.
Ah,
and
you're so thorough.
It's not as thorough as I could have been, but it was that's his purpose here, and I really appreciated it. And like you said, it was written in 1962, and gosh, we're approaching Well, it's more than 50 years ago now. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it's, what is it? Yeah, 50 years would be 2012, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're approaching 60. Well, over 60, mm-hmm. 62 years ago.
Over 60, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, it
is. Didn't even think of that.
Yeah, so really good. But, yeah, I just thought it was terrific. You know, how can you not? Sheed is really, really good and insightful, and I liked, you know, what he had to say.
Yeah, because he's also practical. He'll bring up things that I would actually never think to even ask. And not because I can't ask that, just because it never occurred to me to think about things like, one of my favorite things I remember being struck by the first time I read this book was, he's talking about, so what did the Holy Family talk about? Because they were a family. They weren't just a bunch of holy statues that acted like, you know, just spoke things that wound up in the Bible. They, you know, so at what point did the father and mother think maybe they should broach this topic with their son of his unusual birth, mm-hmm. or any of these things? And I remember commenting about, quoting that on my blog, and somebody's like, you just can't talk about that. Of course he would have known. And I was mm-hmm. like, the question isn't would he have known. The question right here is, what would his parents have known? And how would they have handled it as parents? And he was a young boy. We don't know exactly what he knew when, because he was also fully human. What could a 12-year-old boy handle on that level?
Right,
so,
right.
But just him kind of thinking and talking about all this makes them suddenly come more alive. How would I handle something like that, you know?
Mm, right. Yeah, and exactly. And so, yeah, he spent about, I don't know, something like 60 pages of this 300-page-ish book
mm-hmm.
on the infancy and right. everything, you know, up to then. And there were some things in there that, again, I hadn't, just like you're saying, I just hadn't occurred to me. Like, he talks about on page 35 of my book, he says, mm-hmm. we simply have no mental equipment for reading deep into the mind of one who has never sinned. And he was talking about Mary, you know. He wasn't talking about Christ at that point, right? Because Christ is an infant. But I was like, oh, that's an interesting thought, you know. So he's basically saying, you know, our minds are clouded with sin. And we don't know to what extent, right? You know, we try to keep that thing clear, but not possible, right? But the idea that the implication of Mary being sinless in that context, that was just a line that I was like, oh, you know, it made me think, oh.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you see Mary saying things, you know, she says so little in the Gospels. But you know, I think of the scene where the wedding at Cana, where she talks to Jesus, you know, and he says, "Woman, what do you want from me?" or whatever, you know. And then he's like,
it's
"She's
not my
like,
hour.
Just do what he says," you know, because she knows he's going to do it. But there's this layer that I just hadn't really considered that as a sinless person. You know, I don't have the mental equipment for reading deep into her, which is what he said. I thought that was a very interesting thought.
That's it. And he just puts it in such an interesting way. And for instance, a part that I liked where he was talking about when Jesus, they've gone to Passover, they've left, Jesus isn't with our wagon train, basically. Mm. So they go back and look for him for 3 days and they find him. Astonishing the doctors or of the church and everything there. But and I'm like, a lot of that is stuff that we would know. And he says, oh yeah, we're not astonished, we know who he was. But they say, what did it make the teachers think to hear him answering the questions like this? And so he goes through a series of things that they might have wondered, and I thought, oh, none of these are anything I've ever heard in a homily.
Mm-hmm.
About, you know, did he just do this to set the teachers' minds going in a new direction, even?
Yeah.
But the thing that struck me was Mary and Joseph wondered too. And once again, the Greek verb is stronger than the English. It was as if they had had a sort of electric shock. Why? Not, one imagines, because his answers were brilliant. Most probably what startled, almost stunned them, was to see him showing his brilliance.
Mm.
And I thought that also kind of shows a reflection of the private life of the Holy Family, where they would have known so much more of his capabilities, potential, than anybody in the town around. But here he is outwardly displaying it.
Yeah.
So what does that mean?
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah.
Just, yeah.
Yeah, that's constantly fascinating, you know, and again, you know, contemplating Jesus, you know, as a 12-year-old, he's a 12-year-old boy. At the same time, right. He's God, you know, and sussing that out, like, you know, what does that mean, you know, is really interesting. And having him sit and listen to these teachers and then offer an insight or something, gosh, you know, it's just really interesting, you know, because he's living the human life, which is important. It's like, well, what was the purpose of it? If it's not like the baby Jesus could proclaim the gospel, do you know what I mean? And it's actually, he talks about that a little bit. He's an infant, right? So, but he's still God at the same time. So, but yeah, it's just fascinating to think about. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, wow, you just gave me a real jolt, because when you were talking about, like, when he was an infant, he couldn't do this. And I suddenly went, he sure couldn't, because I've got a 6-day-old granddaughter who can't even hold her head straight, you know, and I've been helping my daughter with her. And I'm just suddenly, the reality of the humanity of Jesus just slammed me in the face.
Oh, yeah.
When you said that, I was like, think of Jesus being like that. And of course he was.
Right.
This, and of course, this is like the thing about Mary. We can't fathom these depths, but we can get a little deeper.
Right, right.
And that's what this whole book does.
Absolutely. And, you know, further contemplation on parenting Jesus. I mean, so, you know, Mary, the angel Gabriel, I love what he had to say about Gabriel, too. That was one of the spots I just loved about it. But I'm on page 61, and he says, you know, I realize, I being the author, right? Yeah. I realize that in judging that God would have done thus or thus, I am in danger of simply deciding what I would have done had I been God, right? It's a danger to which all men are continually exposed, especially scholars, in love with their theory or system. The important thing is to be aware of it, to be constantly checking one's judgments in the hope of excluding it, not to be too absolute where God has not spoken. And then this paragraph here, which just floored me. Those may be right, though they too are fallible and do not actually know any more about it than I, who hold that her son's divinity was not, in the beginning, especially revealed to Mary. Yet explicit revelation is not the only way. She, of all people, could hardly have lived in that moment-to-moment intimacy with a child who was in fact God, and not come to total certainty of his divinity, a certainty which she would have communicated to her husband. If so, her and Joseph's every instinct must have been to lie prostrate, in adoration of his divinity. But that would have meant failing in their duty as parents. While they lie prostrate, the child would have died. Having God in the house like that, we feel, would have kept them in a state of stricken awe, ecstasy shot through with anguish. All babies are adorable, of course, but this one was literally, right?
Yeah.
And then he says, let's see, in the next paragraph, I'm going to skip a couple lines. If we were so stricken with reverent awe that we could not bring ourselves to receive him into our body, we should be nullifying his whole purpose in being there sacramentally.
Yeah, talking about the Eucharist.
Exactly, right. Yeah. So connecting the Mary and Joseph raising Christ as a child to us receiving him sacramentally was quite a thing for me, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're right, you know, this is God, and, you know, I've got to change the diapers and everything, right? But yeah. But at the same time, I'm like, you know, just stricken with awe all the time. But if I was, I couldn't parent. And then extrapolating that to, if we are so in awe of Christ that we can't receive his sacrament, then that negates the whole purpose in what he did or what he's doing by offering himself sacramentally.
Because he came to grow closer to us.
Exactly.
And that's the closest you can get when you're eating the Eucharist.
Absolutely right. You know,
but them as parents having to go, but we have to parent him too.
Right.
And that's also being that close.
That's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing to think about, right?
He's good. That's why this book God is still good. Being published.
Right. But yeah. So it's like, yeah, if we're so stricken in awe of the sacrament, that we can't approach, then it negates his reason for doing that is something that just gives me a lot of thoughts. And, mm-hmm. you know, cause you know, I serve as a Eucharistic minister sometimes, and right. it is heavy, you know, it's like, you know, I'm stricken with awe when I do that. And,
neat.
But it's just something else. You know, there have been times while doing that I've really felt incredible things.
Oh, and really?
Yeah, really. It's just, there have been moments. Yeah. But it's the idea, you know, I'm not worthy of doing that. And that's part of the thing, you know, I'm just like, I'm not worthy of this. I'm not worthy of doing this, you know,
mm-hmm.
But
if not, then what happens?
If not, then no what, one gets right? It, and, right? And I would imagine, you know, a priest may feel that way too. And, yeah.
But that's the thing that Mary and Joseph were dealing with.
Mm-hmm. On a daily basis. and you wonder and you wonder how much they understood and all this, but man, they had
and a lot of those are the things he talks about.
Exactly. You know, because it's just wondering that. What was daily life like? And you know, which we don't see much of, right? We see the birth, and then we see an event when he was 12, and then we see nothing until he was an adult. And I had somebody ask me the other day. He was actually somebody who was into some Eastern stuff, and I'm not Christianity, but Eastern, you know, Tao or other things like
right,
that.
Right.
And he said, you know, I was reading somebody who said that Jesus went to the east as the family went east and all this stuff. Well, I said, well, I don't think that that's so, you know, and because one of the reasons, you know, as I'm going through this book and thinking about that, that kind of shows that it's not so, is Jesus grew up somewhere and he was rejected by his hometown because they were like, aren't you this kid that was running around the street?
Yeah.
You know, I saw you grow up and you're telling me you're what?
You're the Messiah? I don't think so.
Exactly. You know, so, I mean, how could that happen if he went east? So it's like, you know, we have this big gap, and in the gap, that's where people draw their sketches, right? Where mm-hmm. where it says nothing, they doodle. And I think that's just what people do.
Yeah.
So, that's really great. And then there was one other line right here that I just need to read.
Yeah.
One other line. It's on page 62. But it says, because it was talking about, you know, again, this infant is God, and the infant is certainly not preaching the gospel. I mean, he is the gospel, right? But it's right. Like he's not like... The baby Jesus was not talking out loud to people, okay?
No, he's just a baby.
Yeah, and it says, you know, the greatest monarch ruling, the greatest poet writing, the greatest scientist discovering, these are no nearer to the infinity and omnipotence of God than a newborn baby wailing. And that hit me too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like we're stumbling around in the dark here. And mm-hmm. and to think that we are so very close, you know, the greatest scientist, you know, here we are 62 years after he wrote this, right? But nowadays, I would say the zeitgeist is that we're awful smart, you know, when you see Stephen Hawking talking about the end of physics, you know, we've discovered it all. We've hit the end, you know, I think that we're done, you know, and you're just like, there's just no way. There's just no way.
No.
Yeah.
We haven't discovered a fraction of it.
Right. And so the idea that this baby whaling is no nearer that of infinite omnipotence than the smartest scientist you can find. Is a great thought. It's a humbling thought, and it's something that, you know, he just has such a way of putting it that it just strikes me.
Yeah. Well, and like I say, I like his speculations, and he's not speculating in a real concrete way, like mm-hmm. saying, and they surely talked about this and that, but so some of what I was talking about is on page 78. And he's talking about, you know, they had to have talked about these things amongst themselves. And he says, you know, as the boy got older, the talk would have been freer. A time would come when he must be told Joseph was not his father in the way of nature. Is it fanciful to think his mother told him not only of her own virginal conceiving, but of God's message about the child himself? They were a living family, not a set piece. They were not three figures in a ritual, cataleptically rigid in their in their muteness about the things that mattered most, elaborately pretending they were just like anybody else, each wondering how much the other knew. A loving family shares everything, shares knowledge, shares thoughts, and wondering. And then further down in the next paragraph, it says, Mary was not just a convenience to get him born. Joseph, not just a convenience to keep the neighbors from talking. They were the two people closest to God made man. If they did come to talk of the Trinity or of Jesus' Godhead, we need not assume they used the terminology of the church that the church has slowly hammered out. Jesus had his own luminous experience of these truths and may have conveyed their reality more luminously than the fathers of Chalcedon could have dreamed or even comprehended, if only one knew. Hmm. And those are the things where I'm just going, it never occurred to me before I read this book to even think about, what do they talk about? You know? And then he also does some thinking about growing up in Galilee. And so on the next page, he's talking about, you know, the Sea of Galilee wasn't that big. And so he would have been like all boys. He would have wandered around, and it says he would have gone out in the fishing boats. A strong boy can always make himself useful. There were swarms of boys, of course, strong boys and not so strong. He would not have known them all, but he may already have had his eye on a boy called Simon, with a less impulsive elder brother called Andrew from the northern end of the lake. It is hard to imagine Simon at any age not taking whatever limelight was to be had. And I was like, oh, man, if he was ever out in Zebedee's boat, he would have met James and John, younger than himself, probably, but assertive. Tempestuous men have usually been tempestuous boys. And I thought, oh, my gosh, so now he's opened up my thoughts about the youth of the disciples.
Right.
Would they have known each other in other ways? Would they, you know, because the way they're presented in the gospel, we never wonder about that. And it does it matter? Probably not,
mm-hmm.
but it enriches our understanding or our imagination about what things would have been like. These were people too.
Right. Right. So, and yeah.
And he does that again and again and again.
Yeah. And he doesn't, he doesn't imply that he knew them well or anything like that. He's not throwing any of that in there. You know,
but it's just like, hey,
this isn't that big a place. It's like, you can go there. This isn't that big a place. He could have run into these folks, you know?
Right.
That's really interesting because, Mary, Martha and Lazarus were friends of Jesus, right?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like childhood friends.
I never thought about that.
I mean, it just says, you know, he says the one I loved, right? He was like, right. There's a closeness with Lazarus that, again, we may be putting things onto this, but it seems that he was close to Lazarus somehow that's not really said, other than he was the one that I loved. Right. So he's mm-hmm. there. And to say that there was something special about Lazarus and Jesus, you know, maybe they grew up as kids or whatever, but Lazarus was in his hometown, I think.
And he stayed mm-hmm. there whenever he was in the area, he would stay with them. And mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah. Right. Yeah. That's great.
So that's just the first 60 pages of the book.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And something that comes up for me a lot I would say, you know, I'm in Utah, right? So the predominant mm-hmm. religion is the LDS religion. Something that comes up a lot is the idea of brothers. You know, well, Jesus had brothers. And here we have, there's a section called a larger family group. And there is such a great explanation that I will definitely use. It's the best explanation I've seen of the word brothers in the New Testament mm-hmm. when it talks about that. And but it says, you know, so Jesus had brothers. Were they actually blood brothers, children of Mary and Joseph, conceived in the usual way? Not that that would have made him brothers, etc., but the word brothers does not necessarily mean, for the Jews, sons of the same parents. It could mean any close relation. So the Jewish language has no separate word for cousin, or indeed for uncle or aunt, you know? And then mm-hmm. it goes on to say something that I actually need to look up and keep with me. Because there's a point where he calls four of the people brothers. And then later on, there's another scripture reference that says, well, two of these are the sons of Mary of Cleophas. Mm-hmm. Cleophas? Cleophas, is that right? Mm-hmm. How do you say that?
I think Cleophas is how I right. heard it, yeah.
Yeah. So, we find that the mother of the first two on the list, James and Joseph, was Mary of Cleophas, called mm-hmm. by John, Our Lady's sister, quote unquote. So that the first two men in the list were cousins of Christ. So, I mean, that proves that the word can be used for cousins. Right. And then, after that, you know, I'll still probably get denial, but it's like, you know, that's one of the things, you know, because they believe that Jesus is not God and,
right.
And Mary had a family, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And it's funny, reading it through this time and reading that bit, I suddenly was struck. I can't remember if I've said that here before or not, but I suddenly thought of all the Indian movies I've watched.
Hmm.
And there are so many times when there will, say, be a young man with his good friend, and the young man falls in love with somebody, and he starts saying to he calls his friend brother, for one thing. Mm-hmm. And he says, wait, I'm going to take you to meet your sister-in-law. Hmm. Well, he's just dating this girl. They're not even married.
Yeah.
But that's how closely, and this happens in movie after movie. And then the other thing is, you know, two good women friends, they might call each other Didi, which means sister.
Hmm. Yeah.
And that happens over and over. Or any older person is called auntie or uncle. That's just a sign of respect. Mm-hmm. But if you're reading this several hundred years later, and you're not in that culture, you're going to think all these people are a lot more closely related than they actually are. But I suddenly was so struck by the fact that we have modern examples of this.
Yeah,
that's such great. As in those movies.
Yeah, yeah, that's terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as you're talking about that, it makes me think another thing that I really sunk in was this idea of betrothal and what it actually means. Mm. It's funny because I was having a conversation about this like 2 weeks ago with somebody, but the idea of betrothal is not merely an engagement. And he was talking about that early on in
15. Right, it's much more strong.
Yeah. So betrothal for the Jews of that day was not simply an engagement to marry. After betrothal, the couple were husband and wife. Each continued to live at home for a year if the bride was a virgin, for a month if she was a widow. Then came the wedding celebrations and the solemn entry of the bride into the husband's house. In the period between, the marriage act would have been unusual, perhaps, at any rate in Galilee, but it wasn't sinful, for the couple were husband and wife. So I thought that's an interesting thing. You know, it adds a little depth to the, you know, when Joseph was going to let her go away quietly. Right. It still would have been a problem for Mary. But of course, who we assume is Gabriel, came to Joseph. He's not named when he came to Joseph, but.
Well, because it was in a dream.
Right.
God spoke to him in a dream.
Yeah. And, you know, told him, hey, this is what I need you to do. And,
yeah.
So, but it's interesting that the word betrothed is not just, you know, we're agreeing to get married. It's actually was the thing. So
right.
Fascinating.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. And one of the things I liked about the book, and I don't know how much time we have left. I would like to get further into it.
Yeah, please.
It.
Please. Yeah.
But
go wherever you would like.
It kind of, and we've been talking about this already in essence with our examples, but a lot of times what he's doing is illuminating the people around Jesus.
Mm.
So we're seeing Jesus, but he's saying, don't forget this about that person. And you suddenly see it in a new light. And so the thing I'm thinking about is, that's on page 103, and it's talking about when Jesus is being tempted in the wilderness.
Mm.
And he's talking about the duel that's going on here, the scriptural duel between them in the desert. And he says, have steadily in mind who the dualists were. One was the second person of the Blessed Trinity, God from all eternity, yet true man in the human nature he had made his own. The other was a pure spirit, all intellect and will, the will perverted, the will still mighty beyond the human measure. In the 3 years to come, many would question and cross-question Christ, but he was never to confront a mind comparable with Satan's.
Hmm.
It is useful to remember that the conflict we are following involves two spirits, each of them far beyond our own mental power. We may easily be missing some of the swordplay. And so I'm just like, oh my. Somehow I never thought of it on that level.
Right,
you know?
Me neither.
Satan is kind of this incompetent questioner who's trying and going away frustrated because we know Christ is better. Christ can best him, and he does. But you don't stop and think. This brings it down to they're really each other, back and forth.
Yeah.
And Jesus is, of course, superior to the devil, but the devil is superior to anything that any of us could bring. I don't know. I just kind of was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I was really just
definitely
struck by that.
Yeah. Yeah, I am too. Yeah, you know, and we should follow the duo closely. Three thrusts by Satan. Three times parried by Christ. And, you know, you think about the humanity of Christ at the same time. I mean, those temptations, fasting for 40 days and 40 nights seems
right.
Supernatural, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he had a body. He was human, and wanting to turn that stone into bread had to have been tempting. And this thought of that, that Satan had to have been using his very best options.
Especially,
you know?
Since if he thinks this is a human being, he's going to scorn him too. Well, he scorns God anyway. But, and then I was liked that he keeps coming back to this kind of thing. So on page 145, he's talking about the first exorcism that Christ does.
Mm.
And he says, here in the synagogue, hell resumed contact with Christ. This new contact did not involve Satan himself, but one of his demons. And there was no direct tempting of Christ. But it is hard to escape the feeling that Satan was still exploring, trying to find out all he could about this miracle worker. And it says, a few months earlier in the desert, Satan had said, if thou be the Son of God, and had got no answer at all. He had been ordered to go away, and he had gone, but his demons had never ceased to watch and listen. And so, you know, And it also says later, it says he had a long experience of studying men's characters, and there were the miracles. So it's interesting. I never really thought about all these contacts with the demons that are all over the place, that this also is Satan maybe prompting them and also just kind of watching and gauging it against what else he knows of men.
Mm-hmm.
In the way that it's put here.
Yeah. That's fascinating. I marked a spot where that reminds me of Theology for Beginners. Mm-hmm. But he says, I'm in a section called Casting Out Devils, page 148 on mine.
Oh, okay.
Demons are pure spirits, more powerful as spirits than the souls of men, for they have no bodies. Upon the animation of our bodies, our own soul's energy must in part be expended. And they do not depend upon bodily senses for information about the external world. It is clear from Scripture that while they cannot create matter, they can move it about in space, rearranging its parts, working upon it in a variety of ways. They have more power over matter than we have, and need no hands or material instruments for its exercise. But as great as their powers are, demons are limited in their use of them by the will of God. And so, yeah, I mean, the idea that you're talking about, you know, Satan kind of orchestrating this, but basically working to observe and figure out what he's got here, mm-hmm. you know, that's interesting, you know, because, I mean, do we believe Satan knows everything? I don't think we do.
Well, he can't.
Yeah.
Only God knows everything.
Right. That's true.
Mm-hmm. But he would know things that we don't know because he's pure spirit.
Right. And he does.
Because the angels do know things that we don't know, and he's an angel.
Right.
A bad angel, mm-hmm. but an angel.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you would need to know a lot of things in order to tempt man, you know, all the time. It's like he knows what to attack us with.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'd have folded at the bread myself, so. Oh, really? That's all I have to do?
What kind of bread? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Ooh, oh, that's, I didn't even think of that. Is it cheese bread?
Ooh, yeah.
Is there some garlic in there? Yeah, I know.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, yeah. Another thing, kind of as we work through this, I was talking about the temple, and gosh, the reading we just had last week was about the temple. You know, he was talking about,
right,
you know, the tribulation. After this tribulation, the tribulation he was talking about was his prediction that the temple was going to fall. You know, he's talking about Pharisees and Sadducees. You know, he said that after the destruction of the temple, the Sadducees disappeared. And he said, because there's no sacrifice, right? There was no sacrifice anymore.
Right.
There was nowhere for them to be. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was an interesting thing that I hadn't really connected. And I liked it. There's a line here. It says, a religion, be it Pharisee or Catholic or any other, is entitled to be judged by what it actually teaches, not by the various levels of the failure of its members to live up to it.
Oh, yeah. That's beautiful.
Yeah. And
I love that.
Me too, right? Yeah. So, I mean, it's just perfectly put. You got to write that one down.
What page is that on?
It's on page 164 on mine. It's in it seems to me that we're looking at slightly different editions.
I think we are.
So mm-hmm. I have it's a section called Pharisees. And near the end, he says, when considering their sins, we must remember three balancing considerations. And it's number three.
Okay.
Of that.
I see it.
Yeah.
Got it.
But yeah, I mean, so she just opens this stuff up, you know, as we go on, he talks about the miracles and the transfiguration. He's really going through, you know, everything. But,
he is, and he really even, I mean, one of the things I like was just talking about the parables. And I have to say, as I was rereading this time, I realized I read this fairly early after my conversion.
Mm.
And it taught me a lot of the basic things that I knew that I was surprised other people might not know later, like the thing about cousins versus brothers in the language. But there's so much in here that there was a lot of stuff that I didn't remember at all, of course. And one of the things he was talking about, this is chapter 24 instead of a page number, First Sending of the Twelve.
Right.
And it says, suddenly he just bursts into parable. He says he just starts, and he says he created this new way of teaching. And I thought, oh, I thought the rabbis told stories too.
Hmm.
I didn't really think of the parable as being new. Mm-hmm. But it says it was a new thing, truly was a new thing that came into the world that day. The word parable merely means comparison. But in Jesus' use, it means the illustration of spiritual truths by comparison with happenings in ordinary life. Happenings with a plot like the prodigal son or the good Samaritan, in a single incident like a farmer sowing seed, or a natural process like leaven working in meal. But always natural happenings with no animals talking and fish flying. I like that. The elements in the spiritual process are shown related to one another like the elements in the natural process. Our familiarity with the natural process helps us to familiarity with the spiritual.
Mm.
And so then he's talking about all the parables that he told. He goes through and he starts talking about the Sermon on the Mount and all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, all the parables are about God's kingdom in souls.
Hmm.
And I thought, you know, I don't think I ever thought of that as a grouping.
Yeah.
I think of it as individual moral teachings and everything. And in fact, he says, so I think most of us read the parables as magnificent spiritual and moral lessons about God's action in the soul, our own soul, and about our duties to him and to one another. And he says, the parables are indeed about God's kingdom and souls, but as a totality, they were primarily about the kingdom Jesus was to found in the world.
Hmm.
That this is their primary meaning is perhaps the reason for our finding them only in the first three Gospels, written within a generation of his death.
Right.
So anyway, I just thought that was so interesting that even, it makes me think that even if there was such a thing as related to the parable, he told it in such a new way that it was a new thing.
Yeah. Yep, and I can accept that for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And it is.
I could be dumbing it down too much.
Yeah, it is an interesting thing that he wasn't talking that way, and then suddenly it was.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, how do I explain this?
Yeah, now you guys really need to dig a little deeper. Well, yeah. How do I get you there?
Right, and it is. Didn't he say something about, you know, somebody? I think it was probably Peter said, "Why are you talking in parables?" And he said, well, so that those that understand can understand, or something along those lines. Those, it takes you a while to understand them. And if it's like, mm-hmm. if you're with me, you'll understand it.
Right.
Right. Kind of something like that.
Yeah.
Which is great. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, then he sends the 12. Yeah. And the Baptist is murdered. Yeah. The Baptist, that was interesting too. The John the Baptist talk, both at the beginning and moving on here. But just talking about what the relationship was there, or what mm-hmm. it wasn't, you know, how close they were, what John the Baptist knew based on what he said,
mm-hmm.
What he didn't know based on what he said. I thought that was really interesting thinking too.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because all the stuff we've been talking about is what he does all the way through the book. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know how he wrote this.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And kept track incredible. Of everything.
Right. Yep.
Well, there's also a lot of context that he gives that really enlightens you on just based on things that we don't know now.
Mm-hmm.
So. And I'm skipping way ahead to chapter 31, The Man Born Blind.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So it talks at the very beginning about being the light of the world. It says, we have seen Jesus' way of drawing timeless teaching out of some happening of the moment. And so he's talking, he says, oh, well, you know, there's the, he says, well, I'll just go ahead and read it. Mm-hmm. We remember how a Samaritan woman came to draw water at Jacob's well, and he spoke of grace in the soul. The water that I will give him shall become in him a fountain of water springing up into life everlasting. It was after the multiplication of bread in the wilderness that he taught for the first time about the bread of life. The Feast of Tabernacles gave him two opportunities, the great candelabra lighted in the court of women on the first night, and the procession to the pool of Silo to bring back water which should be poured out before the altar of the Most High. He used them both. On the first evening of the festival, golden lampstands were set up in the court of women, a space open to everybody. These stands were enormous, 150 feet high, we are told. And as the lamps were lit, there was a singing of canticles and playing of musical instruments. The sound of the music could be heard 20 miles away in Jericho. Strangest of all to our taste, we read of a Torah dance, with the highest dignitaries of Israel dancing to a set rhythm with lighted torches thrown high into the air and caught again. Again, I cannot help thinking of Indian movies here. Really kind of bring it to life for me. What was in every mind was the pillar of fire which had given light to the Israelites in the desert. The hall of the treasury was in this same court. Here Jesus said, "I am the light of the world. He that follows me walks not in darkness, but shall have the light of life." Light and life are the two keynotes of all these utterances. But what must have caught the attention, especially of his adversaries, was the word world. He was the light of the world, not of one people. They would have remembered a text of Isaiah, a text they were not much given to quoting. "I will make thee a light of the Gentiles to carry my salvation even to the farthest parts of the earth." And then he says, and I won't read this, but he says, you know, the procession to Silo, which was outside the city, would bring back water in this pitcher to be poured out. And that they did that every morning. And it's like the symbol of the water coming out of the rock when Moses is in the desert with the people. And it says, so Jesus said he used it once as a statement about himself and once in the healing of a blind man. So on the last day of the feast, he stood up and cried out, "If any man is thirsty, let him come to me. If a man believes in me, let him drink, as scripture says. Fountains of living water shall flow from his bosom." And that's pretty much what he said to the Samaritan woman, he says. But then, so he's used that, and then he heals the blind man.
Right.
And it says that was, wait a minute, right, with the clay and the water and everything. But it's tied to the pool of Silo because he sends him to wash in the pool of Silo, which is where that water is being drawn to pour on the altar of the Most High. So he's deliberately connecting them that way.
Yeah.
And there's more there, but I've taken up enough time with the reading and everything.
That's fantastic. He says, when his sight was actually restored, Jesus was not even there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. And everybody who was reading this or hearing this for the first time, or certainly the Jewish people, the people who actually saw it when it was happening, would have instantly been connecting all that stuff. And so these are the things that dig deep beneath the skins of the Pharisees and Sadducees, who were there just like, who in the heck does this guy think he is? You know, he is at every opportunity connecting himself with God in the temple and all our worship and all our most sacred things. We don't care for it.
Yeah. Right, right.
So, but once that's explained like that, you just look at it and go, oh my goodness, there's so many layers that I never caught before.
Wow. Love that. There's so much here. I mean, we could read the rest of this whole book,
but nobody wants that. Yeah, but
we're approaching an hour here.
Oh yeah.
Which is an incredibly quick hour. But there's just so much. And I just love the book. I mean, it's like you read this and then you read the Gospels again. And he illuminates things, you know, outside the Gospels as well. Like, I'm here in a section on the Last Supper, and he says, you know, St. Paul was to work out the implications for us. The church is, in a mysterious sense, Christ's own body, its members living with his life as the cells of a man's body live with his. So he's kind of, you know, pointing what St. Paul is doing for us too, outside the Gospels, you know, is helping us understand these things,
right,
helping us unpack what these things mean. But yeah, all of you who have been baptized into Christ have put on Christ, have clothed yourself with him. That's his words. And then it goes back to the quote, "You are all one person in Christ in Galatians. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just a terrific book to read that really cements everything, you know, like you said, the people around him, the, you know, Satan himself, you know, things that are around. And then now when you read the gospel the next time, it's going to be, you're going to notice a lot more.
Yes, and, it's definitely enriched. That's the effect
that it has on me, for sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And when he ends the book, he's saying, I guess this is the last chapter, the resurrection and ascension.
Mm-hmm.
And this is from section 4 of that. But it's just basically, he's talking about what a strange bunch of people the disciples were.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, but the person who foresaw Peter's denials and the flight of the men he'd chosen had seen all these popes. And he's talking about Benedict the Ninth and John the 12th. And he foresaw all the heresies. He foresaw all this stuff. But this is what he chose.
Yes.
It comes through these men. The gifts of truth and life should come through these men and their successors. In union with them, we are in union with him all days until the end of the world. And one of the things that I love, since you just mentioned baptism and now you're one people, he says, there's a misleading phrase, which is baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost. It says the Greek does not mean in the name, but into the name.
Mm.
In other words, Jesus was giving not just the formula of baptism, but the purpose and effect of baptism. By baptism, we are consecrated to the Blessed Trinity, baptized into Christ Jesus. We are brought into life-giving relations with the divine person that he is, and so with Father and Holy Ghost. And I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You know, you forget this, and he gives it all the power and relates it to your own life at that point.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Yeah. It, you know, excites me all over again.
Yeah.
I know. Which is a great effect. And maybe that's the purpose of these Lives of Christ, you know, to do that. You know, and I guess you could call The Chosen a Life of Christ as well. I don't believe that you care to watch it. If you've said,
I watched the first three.
Okay. Yeah.
And they just did not grab me. I really loved what was done with the Mary Magdalene story.
Mm-hmm.
And through those first three, but I had various problems. Like, I kept looking at Jesus and going, who is this guy? Because he's so old.
Mm.
He's not young enough.
Interesting.
And when you look it up, he's like almost 50 or something like that.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't, you know, and there were just different artistic choices. The quality is excellent.
Mm-hmm.
If it grabs you, it grabs you.
Yeah.
I'm really impressed by, while we're off on this little sidebar, I'm really impressed by the Angel Productions studio.
Mm.
And that's who does that, right?
Yeah, I believe they're the distributor. I don't know. Well, I don't really understand how everybody's connected.
Well, but, anyway,
yeah.
Angel Productions' name is on it. And I could really appreciate that because I recently saw Cabrini.
That's one I want to see.
Is about, St. Francis Cabrini. And it was so well done.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
And it was so well done, and I liked it so much that then I went on and watched Sound of Freedom, which had really, I'd been afraid to watch because of the topic. It was also so well done.
Oh, that's cool.
And in fact, Rose and I both were so impressed that now we're inflicting on the family, possibly. They look at it like that, going, oh, now we want to watch the documentary that they did, you know, Sound of Hope. And now we want to watch, there's a movie coming out, Bonhoeffer maybe, out December or November. We want to watch that too.
That's cool.
So we're real fans of the studio, and it's unusual because that's never happened with a Christian studio telling Christian stories. They're just, it's like a renaissance of old golden Hollywood biography telling.
Oh, that's a great way to put that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen Cabrini yet or any of those movies that you just mentioned.
And The Chosen, like I say, I just don't, the way they're telling it is not for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I really appreciate why it grabs so many people. I think they're so well done. I just, you know, I like these movies a lot.
Yeah,
so.
That's good.
And that's right. That is exactly what these books do. Because they're faithful, they give you another way to look at it. They may or may not include details that you treasure from like these, the movies or The Chosen or whatever, from something, but it's because they're looking at something else.
Right.
And this book by Francis Sheed does it much more thoroughly because he's got all these pages where he can really explore things in a different way, mm-hmm. which is the benefit of a book versus the other medium, that's all.
Yeah.
And this does that very same thing. It just opens your mind without changing anything that is faithful that you already know.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, and I think about art as well. You know, how many paintings have been done of various biblical scenes, and you know, the point that the artist is trying to portray sometimes opens things up too.
Think of symphonies and you know, masses, you know, Mozart's masses, and just all these things. There are all these ways the art moves you and opens you up, and this book is a good one.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Yep.
Read it, everybody.
Yes. Go get it.
Oh, I love it. Thank you for reading this book with me.
Oh, I'm so glad you picked it.
Yeah. And I think I will do this every year. I don't mean the podcast. I don't know that we'll do one Life of Christ every year, but a practice I think I'm going to pick up.
That's an interesting idea.
I think it's a really nice thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I like it. I like the idea. And I have Fulton Sheen's biography, or, you know, biography, Life of Christ, sitting there, and I read it maybe once super long time ago, and I was like, oh, that might be good to at least start during Advent.
Very nice.
Because it's quite long. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a big one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lots to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Great choice. Great
very
choice.
Very good. Very good. All right. Well, good. So next for us is Christmas time.
Oh, yes.
And it's our last episode of the year.
Okay.
2024. It's going to be Love Actually. You bet.
It introduced the most popular modern Christmas song right now.
I love it. I love it.
Yep.
You bet.
Yep.
That'll be fun. One. That'll be fun to talk about. Nice and light at the end of the year. So let's do that.
Definitely.
We use some light.
We've been pretty heavy lately.
You bet.
Yep.
So that'll be fun. Well, okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all so much for listening to the podcast.
Yes. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Right. In a couple of weeks.
Yep.
Take care, all. Bye. Happy Advent.
Right. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you.